Talking about.
Lurleen. Lurleen won that thing on her own. She really did. She became very, very popular. And you had old women, 80, 90 years old, going and registering to vote and never voted in their life just so they could vote for her. A lot of people misjudged that thing. A lot of people thought people would not elect a woman governor. Oh, that was a bad thing.
Now, but if she'd been Mrs. Lurleen Smith, she wouldn't have had much success, would she?
Oh, that's right, that's right. The fact that she was, this was unusual. This was peculiar and unusual and different, you know, and this is really what you need in politics to get people interested, you know, and they were interested.
If DeGraffin Reed had lived, would he have been elected?
In my opinion, and this is just my opinion, that Lurleen would have run whether DeGraffin Reed had lived or not. Now, the Wallaces made like that the only reason Lurleen got in the race was because DeGraffin Reed was killed. And they sort of did this to get the support of the DeGraffin Reed people to support Lurleen. But in my judgment, it wouldn't have made no difference whether he lived or not. George would have run his wife, that's my opinion.
Would she have gotten elected?
Yeah. Yeah, they wasn't good enough. 2 weeks after she kicked off that campaign, there wasn't no way in the world of beating her. I think she got about 70% of the vote. Oh, hell, man, it was. I was in that campaign. I ran for re-election that time. I tell you, that was rough. 2 weeks after she started, you everybody knew it was over. You couldn't say it, you know, but everybody knew it was over. And of course, I had been given some credit for beating his succession bill in the Senate. And I might have had a little bit to do with it. DeGraffin Reed, myself, and DeGraffin Reed sort of teamed up to fight that succession bill in the Senate so he couldn't succeed himself. This was a bad mistake.
You were in what capacity?
I was out, see. I was just practicing law, see. But I was going to run. See, I couldn't run for re-election. I laid out 4 years, and while Joy, I'm going to run for re-election.
Your role was more or less in lobbying against the bill.
That's right. I didn't go up there, of course, because that would have been a bad thing to do, but I worked undercover. I worked through my former floor leader who was in the Senate at the time, Vaughn Hill Robinson. And DeGraffin Reed came to town, stayed at the Albert Pick Motel up here, and we sort of collaborated our forces. And Jim Folsom told us, "You're making a mistake." Old Jim, you know, is right many times. He's a smart fellow. He said, "You're making a mistake. That you ought to go ahead and you ought to get behind that thing and pass it. Then the people will have to vote on it, you see, before the election, because it would be a constitutional amendment. And then you just simply watch that vote. If the people vote overwhelmingly for that thing, don't you run. That'll be a good indication for you to stay out of it, you see. It'll be a good barometer to tell you what to do." He was right as hell. He didn't show up. Hell no, we had to kill that thing. Of course, when we killed it, he made an issue out of the fact that we were keeping the people from making the decision. See? They're afraid to let you decide whether or not I should be able to run again or not. See? And just for that, by God, I'm going to run my wife. This is what he did. This was the issue. And you know, the average guy, he buys that kind of stuff. Yeah, by God, he's right. See? That's right. And it sure worked.
Do you know of a better
now, in the Brewer race now, you know, by the time he got around to running, after his wife died, the time he got around to running again, Brewer nearly beat him. And if it hadn't been for that runoff, and probably that race issue, then Brewer would have beat him. So so to that extent, what you say is not exactly right. What you say, he has not maintained a continuous popularity all the time. It bends at some rough places in it.
Is the key to that?
Even in 1972, his popularity before the injury was not great.
That's right. And the reason, of course, I think that there are several reasons for that. One is the longer you're in office, the more decisions you have to make, the more enemies you make. And George has always been a kind of a fellow, you know, he takes a fella's contributions, you know, when he's running and everything, and then when the fella comes around to get state business, he don't go to a lot of trouble or make his people go to a lot of trouble, you know, to give them the business. Many people who supported his campaigns in the past grumble like hell because they've never been able to get any business out of administration, good or bad. They've never been able to get much out of it. So, and once he gets elected, he gets up there and runs it the way he wants to and ignores everybody. In a way, that's good. Of course, in the political sense, it's not. And I think George had made a lot of enemies along the way. And two, I think when you sit down and analyze the whole thing on performance, then you can see where Brewer made some inroads into him on just on simply on performance.
So how do you explain the popularity today?
Here's the way I explain that, right or wrong. This is my thinking. My thinking is that even, of course, being shot, no question about the sympathy vote that that would get. Now, what that is, I have no idea. I can't analyze that. But even with being shot, without one other factor, and a real candidate against him, he would have had a tough race. But the real factor that makes the difference, that could cause the big turnout of vote in his favor and scared all the others out, is the fact that the average guy out there on the street honestly believed that George Wallace can be president of the United States. And he wants to give him that chance. And he feels like that by George Wallace being elected governor again, that this will help make George Wallace president of the United States, or at least give him a chance to be president, and he wants to see him president.
Do you want to see him president?
Yeah, you put a hard one on me there.
Let me rephrase it. How would you feel if he became president?
I want him to ask for that one, then he can go to you.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I know you fellas well enough to answer them. Well, I tell you,
this book isn't going to be published until the spring of 76.
So. George Wallace runs for president, I'm going to support him. I'm going to support him and do whatever I can to help him. I think the chances of George getting the nomination or getting on the ticket as a vice presidential nominee are extremely slim. Be completely wrong about that.
Why? When everybody else is saying that they're getting better because of his relationships with Kennedy and so on.
I don't put in stock in that at all.
No, but today's paper's got a piece that says that.
Well, the New York Times.
Support of Johnny Ford and Evers, and Cooper, and so on. That was all a Kennedy Wallace cabal.
Well, George is going to have a hard time getting that Citizens Council and that Q Klux tag and all that. You know, you get north of Chattanooga, folks think of us down here as all being Kluxers and everything. And although I know George Wallace had never had no part in nothing like that, still, his stand on that race question will be something that will be with him a long time. And the leadership in the Democratic Party, that is the leadership in the big states, are afraid of him. Because they're afraid that they can't get that Jewish vote, that black vote, and that liberal vote with him on that ticket. And that's the only way they win. And some of them in those key states can't afford to support him because of their own local situation. I believe that the thing that brought on this racial problem that we have is the migration of the blacks out of the South into the big cities of the East and the Midwest and the West. And this started largely after World War II. And when they got to those states like New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Ohio, California, they got the right to vote. And they all vote together. That's the only group of folks I know of that vote in a block if they get the word. And they have continue to be the swing vote in those key states. And Harry Truman proved in 1948 that you could be president of the United States without carrying a single southern state if you could carry New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Illinois and California. That's right. And that accounts, in my judgment, for the attitude of the government toward the blacks. They patronize them and cater to them because of their political muscle in the key states. And when it comes to that convention down yonder, they're going to think a long time before they put somebody on that ticket that's going to risk those states. And this is George's biggest problem. And I don't think they come down here to see him because they like him at all. I think probably, and I'm not the only one who thinks this, that they are lulling him into a sense of insecurity about this thing. We want you to have a part in the party affairs. We want you to have a voice and a seat, a table, all this. And come on down to the convention. We're going to give you a big part in the convention and everything. And if he goes along with this and they beat him at that convention, which is what they intend to do, if they can, then it'll be too late for him to organize his third-party effort because it's legally very difficult to get on the ballot in enough states to win, you see. And they will have defeated him simply by delay, doing them any real harm. This is the way I think about it. I think that the Kennedy folks want this fellow Mondale from Texas on the ticket with us. I think they're working on that right now. I think they're trying their best to come up with some alternative to Wallace that would ensure some of these southern states.
Between Benson or Mondale?
Mondale. I've heard Benson too. Mondale. Talking to somebody about that yesterday. Somebody in the Wallace camp who was deeply concerned about the Kennedys and the Humphrey folks fooling around with those with Mondale and Benson.
What, you know what actually brought Kennedy down here in the last year?
God, you know I don't. I really don't. I used to have contact with those people, but I don't have my contacts with them anymore. I have a friend who does, but I haven't talked with him in quite some time. Charlie Merriweather was my finance director, and Charlie went to Washington and became a director on the Export-Import Bank and used to help in some of the Kennedy political activities. And I think probably he might have an opinion about that, but I don't. I just don't. A lot of folks thought that Kennedy made a bad mistake. I mean, a lot of folks down here thought George made a mistake going up there and being with him. I don't know whether it did either one of them any good or not. I really don't. A Kennedy for president ticket would be hard to carry in Alabama. Tough. Of course, if George was on there with him, it'd be a cinch. But then it was hard enough just supporting John Kennedy here. And, you know, even then we had to elect our electors in Alabama. And we had 11 at that time. And then after the election, we fought like hell to elect the Democratic slate of electors. And after the election, damn if they didn't meet up at the Capitol and cast their votes, and 6 out of the 11 voted for Harry Byrd of Virginia. Just threw the damn votes away. Kennedy used to kid me about that. How hard we worked for those bastards, and then men get up there and just throw their vote away. But Ted Kennedy would have a hard time in Alabama.
But wasn't it known before they voted, though, that it was split 6-5?
Not for sure. We couldn't believe.
6 ran as unplayed,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it was some chance.
Yeah, one of them's still here in town, practices law here. Frank Mizell is still here in town. And Frank was the one that we beat for chairman of the Democratic Committee and put in Sam Englehart instead of Frank Mizell and beat him by one vote. Terrible mistake. What I should have done was simply join Frank Mizell and made peace with Frank Mizell. And then we'd have had all the control over the committee we ever would need, and we wouldn't have made any enemy. It wouldn't have cost us anything. And George Wallace could not have helped himself very much, even had he beat Mr. Vance. But the only injury he got out of that thing was simply a few stories that might imply in other places that he's not as strong down here as he makes out like he is. But God, look at that last election. That's just a cinch. He didn't spend any money much.
Well, he didn't really have any opposition much, did he?
That's correct. He didn't.
I mean, Dale Bumper's got a larger majority in Arkansas against Fulbright than Wallace got here for governor.
Well, I was surprised that a lot of folks just didn't go vote. But I was surprised at the number of votes that young fella got. I was surprised at that.
Were you surprised at that? I mean, does that suggest there's a 36% built-in anti-Wallace voting?
I think that's true. Probably more than that.
What do you think of the theory that Wallace's whole life is one of campaigning for public office, and that when 1978 comes, and suppose he's not a vice president, that he's going to try to run his wife or one of his relatives or to perpetuate his control?
Well, I honestly believe that he'll try to name his successor. Yes, I believe that. You're right about that.
Can he do that if it's not somebody in the family?
That's, you know, well, he's the only guy that ever has done it. He can get it with his wife. He's the only guy.
But I would say, he was almost running himself.
I would say no. I don't believe that George Wallace will ever again be able to name his successor unless whoever he supports just simply happens to be a leading contender. Now, I mean, if you had somebody who, you know, had something going to start with, he could possibly, you know, in effect, help re-elect his successor. But I don't think he can pick somebody out there who's not a contender and not, you know, unusually qualified and name him governor. No, I don't think so.
You think it's more likely that he'd run for the U.S. Senate?
You know, he has never expressed a desire to go to Washington and has never and has said on a number of occasions that he was not interested in going to the United States Senate. Huh?
I said Washington in that capacity.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Senator. No, he has never expressed an interest in that, and has in fact expressed an interest in disinterest in.
But is that interest or that explanation about his interest in campaigning and politics, is that a fairly good explanation of his personality?
Yeah.
Is it one?
Yeah, I agree with that.
It just dominates his life, and that.
The day he came back from the Air Force, he started running for the legislature, and that's when I first met him. He was I was with my father, who was in the Senate. We were down at the Eli Cafe, and he introduced me to George Wallace, and George Wallace was in law school at that time, and he was in the legislature, too. He'd just been elected. This is 1946, and I remember it very well, and George looked at me just like a boy. He was just like a little boy. He looked just like a little boy. And from that time on, my own knowledge, he had been 100% interested in nothing but running for office. So
there's nothing to suggest that when the term ends in 78 that interest is going to die.
No, it'll continue. I'm convinced of that. Yes, sir. And that's why I say that if he's not on the national scene in some way, then he'll run. He will try to name his successor. No, I don't think there's any question about it. I don't believe he'd amend that Constitution again. I don't believe that. Now, because during this administration, this time, he has not had control of the legislature. And he has not, and I think he probably could control the legislature. But there again, George is not willing to pay the price of doing that. He has been very lucky. He has been very, very lucky in that all the time he's been governor, we have had relatively economic prosperity. He has had plenty of money. There has not been a single recession. Nothing but just constantly increasing revenues all the time, about 15% a year. And then on top of all of that comes revenue share, which they let him give away, just like he wants to give it out to anybody. That's the damnest thing I ever saw. So he's never really had to interest himself in the inner workings of the legislature and really use his office to get something done up there. He's up to this last legislature, he's been able to pretty well demand what he wanted, simply because he was so popular back home where they came from. I've heard him threaten to go back and to make speeches against them. Hell, they just knuckle right under. During this last session, he just ignored them. And they went ahead and did pretty well what he wanted anyway. But he just sort of ignored them, stayed away from them. Had plenty of money, didn't have to worry about anything. Even the press, with the pressure of the press, got them to pass the appropriation bills early, which was a very bad mistake for them. And then he went home. They couldn't even find him. And then you had a legislature that passed the appropriation bills early, and then the governor had all he wanted, and he didn't spend no more time with them. And they just floundered out to the end. Of course, they shouldn't have done that. They should have waited for the last night. Then they'd have had that governor down there.
So, it's basically a weak legislature, isn't it?
Sure.
Institutionally weak.
Yeah.
They meet still annually? I mean, they meet annually?
No.
They still meet biannually?
Biannually. Oh, yeah.
And is it a limited session then?
Yeah, 36 legislative days. Now, they drag it out from about, Tuesday in May to about the 1st of October. They drag it out. They meet 2 days a week and have committee meetings on 3 days and pay this up for 5 days. But
A legislator gets about $10,000 a year. He could get about $10,000 a year out of it. That's about all. Now, you know traditionally that the governor in Alabama, traditionally the governor names the speaker.
Right.
And this has always happened. And they just automatically do this. This gives the governor, of course, control of the key committees in the House and control of the legislation in the House. The lieutenant governor, traditionally in Alabama, has given the governor his charge of the appointment of a majority of the Rules Committee and the Finance and Taxation Committee of the Senate. And as far as I know, this has always been the case in modern times. Beasley did this for George this last time. And we have a 7-man Rules Committee, and all the rest of them are 15 members. But the lieutenant governor traditionally has let the governor pick 4 out of the 7-man Rules Committee and 8 out of the 15-man Finance and Taxation Committee.
How about the chairman?
Well, with... No. Just the majority of the membership. That's right. Just
but traditionally, does the lieutenant governor appoint one of that a member of that majority as chairman?
It sort of depends upon whether or not... It wouldn't make a great deal of difference, really, if you had a majority of them. But traditionally, I would say yes. Traditionally, the lieutenant governor has pretty well gotten along with the governor. Very rare occasion when you have a lieutenant governor don't get along with the
But they don't really run as a team, right? I mean,
he doesn't
designate his running mate.
That's right. Of course, that's a one-party system again. You see, now the leadership in the legislature is going to come from some source. And when it's a strictly a one-party state like Alabama is, that leadership is going to come from the governor.
The Rules Committee in the Senate is powerful. Why?
Well, they determine the special order calendar in the final days of the session. You know, everything bogs down to the end, you know. And there at the tail end of the session, you've got a tremendous calendar with all the important legislation. Usually you've got the appropriation bills usually there. All right, the Rules Committee then can come out with a special order calendar anytime they want to, and they can just move stuff up to the top of the calendar, you see. All right, the Rules Committee can cut off debate, you see. Under our rule here, you have to have a resolution from the Rules Committee to vote on the cutting off of debate in the Senate. Otherwise, you've got unlimited possibilities for filibusters. So
if you control the Rules Committee and you control the Finance and Taxation Committee, you don't need anything else, right?
That's right. The only other person you have to worry about be the lieutenant governor. He could sit up there with that gavel and arbitrarily block things, but he can't get away with that. He might try it, but that Senate would probably revolt on him, revolt against him on that thing. And they could curb his authority. But
Does the lieutenant governor, by law, have the power to, by statute, have the power, or Constitution have the power to appoint committees, or is that just tradition?
No, he has the power to do it.
But I mean, is it statutory or constitutional power?
It's constitutional, I believe. I believe I'm right about that.
Is seniority much of a factor?
No, none. None.
What is allegiance to the governor?
Yeah. Or a friend of the...
And in the House, that's purely precedent. That's not in the rules or statutory or...
That's right.
Purely precedent.
Purely traditional. That's right.
So Alabama, the governor of Alabama really is one of the most powerful governor's offices in the nation, right?
No question about it. I would rate it near the top. Yeah.
So Alabama, Louisiana...
Even though he shares the executive power with several other constitutional officers, like the Attorney General and Treasurer, the Secretary of State, Auditor, and the State Commissioner of Agriculture and Industries. Still, the Constitution charges him with seeing to it that all the laws are enforced, including all those that they enforce. And he can call on them for information under oath, and the refusal to do so is grounds for impeachment. So the governor is really all powerful in the executive branch, and with the traditional power he has in the legislative branch, I'd say yes, he's one of the strongest in the United States.
Let me ask you, suppose Wallace as governor were to decide, by golly, he'd really like to revamp the tax structure of the state. He'd like to maybe even, is the sales tax include food and drugs in Alabama?
Yes, it does now, yeah.
Now, let's say he'd like to get rid of the sales tax on food and drugs. Is it a state income tax?
Yes.
With 5% maximum.
Maximum 5%.
That's by constitution.
That's correct, yeah.
All right, and he'd like to get a constitutional amendment to change that, increase it, move the limit, or increase it to 7 or whatever, and replace that. If he really wanted to do that, considering the power he's got, that he in effect can select name committees and the people who are on it, would there be any reason why he couldn't do that?
No. He can do it. If he took that on as a program, it could be done. Now, he would have to be willing to use the powers of his office, the powers of patronage and persuasion that the office has, probably to get it done. But if he were willing to do what he could do, legally, I'm talking about, not, I'm not talking about anything illegitimate,
right.
Then the answer is yes. I have no question what he could do. And it should be done. It should be done.
I mean, this goes back to the original question, George Wallace really liberal. I know he has this, people in Alabama say he is, and he likes to sort of project it nationally, you know, I really am, and I'm a populist, but I haven't quite seen the evidence.
Well,
they say the rhetoric is there.
Yeah, now you're
getting performance is not.
Yeah. Well, I said a while ago, based on performance, I think Brewer's showing against Wallace was because of Wallace's overall performance.
Was it also a reflection that Alabama was beginning to get tired of the rhetoric and isn't?
No question about it. Same people are tired of the same old
new image of Wallace. Isn't
great, everything is, you know, everything's great, you know, but you know, it really ain't great.
The new rhetoric is much more of a
George is not particularly interested in going to a lot of trouble to, you know, for wholesale reorganization of state finances and things of this kind. I've heard his own people say, his own kinfolk say, that George knows how to get elected, but once he gets up there, he devotes his time to other things other than running the office.
Well, what you said about taxes, isn't the same thing true about executive reorganization? Most of the governors in the South that have taken on a program of the consolidation of the executive branch down to 20 agencies or 15 or whatever, most of them have at least tried.
Yeah. George's interests lie in other directions. I don't think that George wants to tie up his time in that kind of thing. I think he's more interested in the overall politics than he is in the day-to-day running of the office or any attempt to try to reorganize the state government. I think this is the least of his concerns.
Insofar as ability is concerned, if he decide to do that, set his mind on administration and running the office, is any question in your mind insofar as him having the ability to perform well in that capacity?
He could do it if he set his mind to do it. I'd say again, you've got to be willing to pay the price. And of course, and what I'm talking about is this: you've got to call that senator down there that's blocking your program or blocking some bill you got to have, and you got to say, "Now look, by God, if you want that damn bridge up there over that river, you go back up there and vote for this bill, or you're not going to get this bridge." You see.
But in Alabama, the governor can deliver on that sort of thing.
Absolutely,
right?
You got to find out what it is that fellow that's bottlenecking your program, what it is that he's got, he wants to keep that you can take away from him, or what it is he wants very badly that you can give him, and you got to use every conceivable pressure that you can bring to bear on a fellow to force him around to your way of thinking. Now George has never done that. He's not good at that. A few attempts that they made to bring pressure to bear on people that I know about, particularly during that succession fight, backfired on them, because you don't put pressure the way some of his folks try to do it. You see.
Does he have a
confidence? You're gonna vote the way I do, or I'm gonna knock your brains out. You know, the average guy says, "Hell, you go to hell." So it ain't the way he does it. Now George has never been good at that, and he's never had to do that. You see. And a lot of difference when you, I remember one time I was faced with a recession, and during that Eisenhower recession and a 100-day steel strike in Birmingham, which caused a tremendous drop in sales tax. And goddamn, we were running out of money, and we were in a hell of a shape. We were having to prorate school funds. And when you get in that kind of a situation, you have to devote your time to the business of the state. You can't be interested in anything else. Now, George has been very fortunate, and he's never had problems of that kind. He's had plenty of money ever since he's been up there. In fact, too much. Run a surplus every time.
Had he ever been tested in any economic or social crisis? I mean, other than the race thing, was he sort of, you know, as you say, drew the line and made the confrontation? Has he ever been really tested?
No, that's about, you're about right. That's, you see that penny sales tax breeze through up there. And this, of course.
But that really wasn't his program either. I mean, he really didn't really work to get that through, did he?
Didn't he pledge himself against the sales tax increase?
Oh, yeah, he ran against it, pledged against the sales tax, and then turned around and supported it.
Yeah.
But there was a quite a head of steam up on that at that time to try to, you know, break out of this education problems that we were in at that time. Of course, that penny sales tax made it possible for us to make tremendous strides in public education at that time. I think some of it was misdirected.
But that was the only...
Built too many junior colleges. Hell, they got junior colleges someplace. You almost hit three of them with a rock in one place. Overbuilt. Poor planning. Really poor planning.
Am I correct, though, that sales tax was not part of a package? It was just a 1 cent sales tax increase.
Yep. And he ran it, and he was pledged not to put it on when he ran for office. Because when I was in office, I ran against putting on a sales tax, too. When I was in office, we didn't put one on. We took some exemption. When I was there, we took the way we financed the largest increase in funds for schools up to that time in the history of Alabama was when I was in office. A $35 million a year increase in appropriation plus a $100 million school construction program. And we financed it by taking the exemptions off of heavy machinery. Now, you're talking about a fight with the big mules. Now, we had one over there. At that time, machinery, for instance, dynamos in the Alabama Power Company plants were exempt from sales tax. And the looms in the mills and the lathes and all was exempt from sales tax. So we financed it by taking the sales tax exemptions off of heavy machinery. In effect, we put the burden on the industry.
Including manufacturing machinery.
Right. Man, that was a bitter damn thing. And it passed the Senate by one vote. And I never got through paying for it. I mean, it nearly wrecked my administration to do it. But I did it for the school people, and of course, they weren't very grateful for it. Because they didn't realize that. How hard it was to get it done. They really did. And the lieutenant governor had always tried to make like that he was a supporter of public education, but when he came down to that damn bill, he fought it. And when he appointed a conference committee, he appointed three members of the conference committee that were against the legislation. We anticipated this and had the speaker to appoint three that was for it. We didn't follow the traditional rules of appointing conference committee. So when they met, there were three and three. If it hadn't been for that, we'd have been whipped early. But we did get it through. You're right about George has been very fortunate in that all the time he's been in office, we have had a relatively good times. Really have. Plenty of money.
You gonna run for office again?
No. I've made up my mind about that. I'm just 52 years old, but you have to decide at some time in your life whether you want to, you know, have a profession and a business and have anything for yourself and your family, or whether you want to just fool with politics all your life. You just can't continue to fool with gubernatorial politics. It's too short life. And if you want to continue to run all the time and do all the things that are necessary to stay in the public eye, you've got to have a private income. You've got to have a base. It's expensive. And you can't make any money at it. And George Wallace don't have any money. If George Wallace had to get up $10,000 right now to put a down payment on a house, he'd have to go borrow it. He gives no thought whatsoever to his future financially, or anything like that. Just, he operates as if that day is never going to come. It's a bad thing, too.
So insofar as personal honesty is concerned?
Well, I have no doubt about his honesty. I think he's like all governors. He's made some mistakes in judgment in the appointment of people. But you know, if you're right half the time, picking people, and you're lucky. But he doesn't hesitate to cut their heads off when they get in trouble. And this is something good to see for him.
Does he have a competent staff?
I would say that it was competent enough to function. Could you find somebody, you know, that might do a job better? Probably so. Of course, you're not always the best fellow gets elected governor either, you know. But I think by and large, he's got a pretty good staff. I don't think he delegates much authority.
The state's industrial growth and economic development in the last 12 years resulted because of George Wallace, or in spite of George Wallace?
No, I think that was going to come anyway.
What are the major forces behind that? Just the economic forces in the state?
Oh, I think this part of the country, the southeast, is developing. People are moving down here. The population is, to some extent, growing, not particularly here, but in Florida and places like that. I think it was just bound to come. I think this just happened. I do think, though, that George is responsible for the Industrial Bond Act, which has probably given us more small industry and more scattered industry than we would have got without it.
Is this Tennessee Tom Bigsby project going to be the biggest thing?
Yeah, that's going to be a big thing.
Yeah. Does that result more from the congressional delegation?
No, they've been working on that thing since. The first drawing of that thing was drawn by the French, when the French controlled the Louisiana Territory. That's how old that thing is. That's right. That thing has been in the cards for many, many years. The first appropriation to start construction on that project came from John Kennedy. That's right.
Was your office involved in
that? Yeah. I went up and appeared as a witness before the committee. Mr. Cannon's committee at that time, tough old bird. That was the first money for construction, and that was open the door. See. But that thing, but I can't take credit for that, man. That thing started many administrations before mine. Had a hand in getting that thing going. Now, the reason that thing is so important is that this will give shippers a slack water route, no current, both ways, see, from the Gulf to Chicago. It's just a tremendous thing. See, now they have to buck that current up the Mississippi going back. So.
Does John Sparkman play any significant role in Alabama politics?
Yeah, I think so.
What way?
Well, it's John Sparkman has a lot of friends in Alabama that he's made over the years that are in influential positions, and a lot of them in the banking industry. And he has calls on these people, and he's somebody to be reckoned with in Alabama, no question about that.
But, I mean, does he help other candidates?
No. No, sir. After the two-party state, you know, they might. Now, he came down here, you know, and I think appeared a couple of times and made a little talk for the Democratic ticket when Lyndon Johnson was running. But that's safe enough to do that in a general election in Alabama, you know. That's pretty safe to do that. But as far as getting involved in anybody else's race, other than possibly speaking on behalf of the Democratic ticket during the presidential race, no, he never got involved in any local politics now.
To what extent does Wallace get involved in other races?
None. Absolutely none.
How about this lieutenant governor's runoff?
Yeah, he had nothing to do with it all. He had a hard time keeping his people from getting mixed up in it. And some of them got deeply involved in it. You just can't control all your people. And I think if some of his people are looking way ahead, they figure that Beasley's going to be the next governor, and they want a piece of the action when George is gone. I think some of them are looking that far ahead.
You think he's going to be the next governor?
Oh, I don't have no idea. What do you think? Senator Sparkman has. He and Senator Hill collaborated for years in passing out the federal patronage. And so you have not only key people around in business and financial circles that are deeply obligated to Senator Sparkman, But you also have a lot of federal office holders that are deeply obligated to Senator Spartan as well.
What was Judge Reeves' role?
Well, of course, I think that Senator Hill and Spartan both were instrumental in the original appointment of Judge Reeves to the bench. But Judge Reeves, once he got on the bench and all, he just took the tack of the Judge Johnson. He was, man, he was rough on us. We're talking about the enforcement of the carrying out the law of the land as announced by the United States Supreme Court. Now, Judge Reeves did his part. He was like Judge Johnson. In fact, he still sits on cases. He's still around. We knew that. A very honorable man, incidentally. A very honorable man. Very much of a liberal, in my judgment. See, he and Frank Johnson have had a great deal to do with the implementation of the Brown decision.
I heard someone even go so far to say that the legislature doesn't, and the governor don't really run the state of Alabama because it's all in the control of the federal court.
It's all because, and it's because of these certain controversial issues that are hot potatoes politically, that the state, where the state has simply defaulted and has refused to carry out what the state was supposed to do itself. And how in the hell can you complain if the federal court steps in and does it where, by God, you refuse to do it? See? And the reason they refuse to do it is simply because the leaders feel like it's safer politically for them to let the federal courts do it, cuss the courts for doing it, and it keeps them from having to do it themselves. And if they did it themselves, they probably couldn't get reelected. This is the way I analyze it. Reapportionment of the legislature. The Alabama Constitution specifically says, the 19-1 Constitution specifically says, that the legislature should reapportion itself every 10 years based on the decennial census. And that each house of the Alabama legislature would have to be as near equal as far as the vote was concerned, that is, to each house had to be on a population basis in Alabama. So we had no complaint even about that. But, and of course, they never would do it. And it got, I don't know whether you read that, there's an Alabama Law Review article on that question that spells that thing out in great detail. And the federal court here gave the state of Alabama, gave the legislature and the governor years to do something about it themselves. And then recently, when they finally adopted this professor's plan, what's his name, Valesky from NYU, when they finally adopted his plan of one man, one vote, and did away with and single-member districts, even then the judge asked the state of Alabama to file a suggested plan. And hell, the attorney general filed a plan that was so far out of line it could not possibly have been accepted. So they didn't even come up, the state didn't even come up with a feasible plan. And the court probably would have accepted multi-member districts. They even indicated in their opinion that if you'd come up with a feasible plan, they might even accept a multi-member district. But they didn't. The only feasible plan was the one of the plaintiffs by Dr. Valesky. And that, so now we have the single member district and the one man, one vote formula, which has brought this thing about. Same is true with the tax thing. We refused, just flat refused. You know, the thing, for years, we had to assess property on 60% of fair market value. So, but now it's down to 30, and still they're not doing it. And they don't intend to do it, in my opinion. The federal court is going to have to reassess our property value. You can't get that local tax assessor.
So then the contention that the courts, are, federal courts, are either running the state of Alabama is not very far fetched.
Yeah. All right. Take
mental health.
Mental health. Let's see. If the state picks people up off the street who are supposed to be crazy, who haven't hurt anybody, have violated any law, and sends them over to the state hospital, the only constitutional justification for depriving them of their liberty is that you're going to treat them. And once you get them over, if you don't treat them, you violate their constitutional rights by keeping them. And all Frank Johnson said here is you treat them, if you pick them up and take them over there and lock them up, you got to treat them to up to a certain standard, or you got to send them home. See, that's all he said. Now, the state has not done anything about that. We'll get back to that performance thing again, is what I'm talking about.
So if the next governor of Alabama turned out to be somebody who really wanted to institute a great deal of reform, he likely would get a great deal accomplished, right?
Yeah.
If you were willing to work at it with the legislature.
It'd be a good time. You're going to have to be somebody, though, that understands the nature of the process and who's willing to do what is required to be done to get it done. Now, you understand that legislature is a coming together of all the conflicting economic interests of a state. And there might be a guy in there that thinks that he is there to do what is best for all his constituents, regardless of his own personal views or anything else. But in the final analysis, when it comes down to a showdown on something controversial, he will vote his economic interest or the group he comes out of. And the governor's got to tackle that thing. He's got to understand that the very nature of the thing is a compromise.
Didn't Alabama about due for a new constitution?
Yeah, oh God, yeah. And again, we're going to get it piecemeal, though. We got a new judicial article, you see. We're going to get it piecemeal. And have you seen the proposed new constitution? It's very brief, it's a form. He was one of the...
And it's the role of probate judge in the county government. Is that the key position?
That's the strongest position in the county.
What does he...
Particularly in a county like that. See, in a county, a small rural county, the probate judge acts as county judge and handles misdemeanors and preliminary hearings. He acts as juvenile judge, and he acts as judge of the county court, the county commission, and sits as a member of the county commission and has a vote in the handling of making county government decisions.
Does he in effect function as chairman of the county commission?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And dominant figure.
That's right.
So he has both judicial and administrative.
That's decisions. Correct. It's the strongest position in the county. The second position, of course, would be the sheriff. The sheriff is the only constitutional officer in the county. And the sheriff is a very formal position, too. Not that he has any, authority other than political. His authority really, his influence is really political. The sheriff does